Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Today's guest was born in Brooklyn and raised in New Jersey off the same Highway 9 Bruce Springsteen sings about on Born to Run. She graduated from Emerson College with a BFA in writing, literature, and publishing. She lives in Asbury Park, New Jersey, with her husband and their rescue dog, Barry. Welcome Home, Caroline Klein is her first novel. It's my pleasure to welcome Courtney Price. Courtney, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Bianca. It's my absolute dream to be on this podcast. I'm such a longtime listener and fan, so thank you.
It's incredible to have you on the podcast because you and I met and spoke about this, I think, just as you sold the novel. Can you remember when we met?
I do. I remember the day that we met because it was the day that I signed with my agent. You were doing an event at East City Bookshop, which is a beloved bookstore for both of us. And I have family in DC and I knew that you were coming to town. So I went to go visit so I could catch you on your tour stop. And I just so happened to have signed with my agent. I think it was like that morning I sent over the agency agreement. And I had been querying for close to a year, 10 months, and listening to this podcast as my constant companion. So it was a very surreal, like full circle moment. And I emailed you like pretty much as soon as we ended up selling the novel. I had to let you know.
Yeah, you know what? I remember that we were celebrating. We weren't just celebrating my book coming out. I remember we were celebrating something for you, but I was second guessing myself whether it was your agent or whether you sold the book, because that was in the summer of 2022. And here we are in the April of 2024, and the book is already out and it is already doing so incredibly well. So for me, it feels like it happened really fast, but I know for you, it feels like it was moving at a glacial pace, right? So before we get into all of that, I'm just going to read the flap copy for our listeners so we know the book that we're talking about. So here we go for everybody. The book is Welcome Home, Caroline Klein. In New York City, newly single Caroline is stumbling away through the recent implosion of her life. After a surprise breakup leaves her with no job, no apartment, no backup plan, she's unsure of what to do next. That is until Caroline's father, Leo, injures himself in a bad fall and asks her to move home to the Jersey Shore suburb she'd always been desperate to escape. But Leo doesn't want his daughter to be his caretaker. He needs her to replace him as third baseman in his local men's softball league. This isn't just any season, Leo claims. This is the year they have a real shot at the World Series. Caroline agrees to move home, concerned that Leo is hiding a more serious health condition than he's willing to admit. As the first female player in a league full of old school men, she's up against more than a few challenges. And when a night gone wrong leads her to experiment with sobriety, unknowingly placing her back in the orbit of her hometown crush and first love, Caroline struggles to reconcile the life she thought she'd have with the life she might actually want. So, such an amazing premise. So, before we go through your journey to publication, which sounds absolutely fascinating, Courtney, I would love you to tell our listeners the wonderful news you got while you were out on tour about the book.
Oh my God. Yes. I'm very excited to share. I was speaking with my publishing team yesterday and we received the news that Welcome Home, Caroline Klein is an instant national bestseller. It made the USA Today bestseller list, which is truly beyond my wildest dreams. I got word of that as I was getting on the plane from my DC tour stop to my Boston tour stop. And there was a lot of crying on the plane. The plane is the best place to cry. So it was great timing.
Certainly airports are the best place to cry. That's incredible. Congratulations. That's just the best news. Right. So why don't you take us through the origin story of Welcome Home, Caroline Klein, and then your journey to publication?
Absolutely. So the origin story of this book, it was inspired by an incident that actually happened to me on my 30th birthday. I went back to my hometown, which is in Monmouth County, New Jersey, Jersey Shore hometown. I was going to watch my father and my brothers play in a Sunday morning softball game. They all play in the local men's softball league. My father's played in that league for 30 years, but my dad was actually sidelined with an injury that day, not nearly as severe as the one that Leo in the novel is sidelined with, but my dad had a minor injury and I had this, you know, surreal experience of watching the game with him next to me. And so, you know, I joked about taking his place on the team. That was something that my sister and I sort of regularly threatened to do after my brothers came of age and were allowed to join the men's team. You know, my sister and I are consummate baseball players. So, you know, we would joke about like tucking our hair up under our caps and like, we're going to take your spot. And so that sort of joking threat turned into the idea for Welcome Home, Caroline Klein. I actually moved to Asbury Park, New Jersey about a month later after living in Brooklyn for a decade. And that's when I started writing this novel in earnest on my long commutes on the New Jersey Transit back to Manhattan for work every day.
Yeah, commutes can be really useful when you are not driving and when you can be working on something. So, I mean, in terms of the iterations, how long did it take you to write it? Then how long, you know, you spoke earlier about in terms of getting the agent. And after that, after getting the agent, how long did you work on it and how long until you sold it? Take us through that.
Okay. I feel like there's like a little bit of background, like pre-me writing this, that I feel like the folks who listen to this podcast are like my people because I also listen to this podcast. So I want everyone to know that this is the first time I tried to write a novel, but it is not the first time I tried to write a book. I actually had an agent in my early 20s who I'd met socially, and I had written a collection of essays that we took out on submission as a memoir, and it died on submission. And that was around like 2017. So fast forward to 2019 is when I got the idea for this novel. It was my first sort of like foray into trying to write long form fiction. So this is really the novel that like I was teaching myself how to write fiction in writing this. I started writing it in earnest around like fall 2019. I was supposed to be working on another nonfiction project to follow up the one that did not sell. And I kind of kept cheating on that document with a document that had this novel in it. And I remember talking to one of my best friends is Rachel Harrison, who is a horror novelist. And, you know, I remember talking to her and telling her about this idea. I'm like, oh, I'm kind of cheating with this document in the background. And when I pitched it to her, she said, "That's not your mistress. Marry the bitch." So I started. I know it's a great line. If you like that line, definitely check out her work. She's very funny. I started writing it like new document, full force, November 2019. I was sort of working on it through the beginning of 2020, but we all know what happened in March. And I was honestly just too paralyzed by anxiety, like could barely sleep or eat. So I kind of took a break from writing that. But then Jamie Attenberg actually has this 1,000 words of summer writing challenge, where it's 2 weeks of committing to writing 1,000 words a day. And I was really, you know, at the height of the pandemic, I was just like really needing to find a happy place within this manuscript again. So I started writing 1,000 words a day. I joined that writing challenge. And it turned out to be the, you know, routine that I was lacking. And it taught me accountability. And I ended up, you know, writing past the 2 weeks. I wrote 1,000 words a day until the novel was done, which I finished the first draft the day before my 31st birthday. So it was exactly a year from coming up with the idea to finishing a draft. And then I spent, I think I told you, I spent 10 months querying it. I spent a long time editing it. I had been with an agent who, again, I was signed on to do nonfiction projects with. And so I, you know, needed to find a new agent who I could work with for fiction. And it took me a while to get the draft into a good place. And I started querying around November 2021 and signed with my agent in September 2022.
Wow. And in that time, like how many rejections did you get? Were you getting rejections that were near misses, they had request fulls, or was it form rejections? Because I think this is some of the biggest problems that our listeners grapple with. How do they know when they're getting close? You know, did you get a sense that you were getting close in terms of the rejections you were getting?
That's such a good question. I got a lot of rejections. I think that I ended up querying 75 agents and I received offers in the end from 3. And I did it in small batches. I know that listeners have like different approaches. I did mine in small batches and I got every kind of rejection under the sun. I got, you know, zero response. I got form rejections. I got partial request, then rejection. I got full request. And then it's so funny. I had a very similar response to like multiple full requests, which was, "We love the writing, but I don't love it enough to go to the mat for it." And I was just like, who knew that agents loved wrestling metaphors like this? It's so much. I don't think I can go to the mat for it. And I took a little break too. You know, like I would take breaks in between because I definitely, it takes a toll on you mentally to deal with rejection. We're not meant to, you know, handle rejection at that fast a clip. And, you know, so I took a little break. I knew that I had an opportunity to kind of like go out with a big push, like a bigger batch than I had done previously, because there was a TV show version of the Women in Baseball movie, A League of Their Own, that was coming out in August. And so around June, I was like, I'm not going to send out my small batches of queries anymore. I'm going to hold off until August, which, again, I think your listeners will know, traditionally a dead time in publishing, and people are like, don't query in August. I queried in August, so there you go. I waited until that show came out, and then the day after it premiered, I sort of started including that in my query letters. I was just like, this would be great for fans of A League of Their Own, which is, you know, back in the cultural conversation, back in the zeitgeist. And that netted me a lot of full requests. And my agent, who I am now signed with, was a full request that turned into, you know, a phone call from that August batch of queries. So
That's incredible. And I love how intentional and how smart you were about that, you know, because there's so much we can't control when it comes to querying. We can write the best book we can write the best query letter we can. A lot of that is so out of our control. And yet you took a situation that is very much uncontrollable and you went, okay, I'm going to position this at the best possible time, even though it's a, you know, so-called slow time in the industry. And that was extremely smart. So something for our listeners to take away there is if there is something coming out, if there is a cultural conversation, if you are seeing, you know, that something similar to your work is coming up, perhaps wait and see the response to that and go from there. Courtney, is there any way that we could make your query letter, taking out all, you know, whatever details you don't want, available to our Substack supporters? Because I know that they are desperate to see successful query letters.
Absolutely. I would be thrilled to share with you guys.
Oh, our listeners are cheering now because I know that, you know, we on Books with Hooks look at so many query letters where we're like, this can be elevated, but they love seeing the ones that really shone and that landed the agent. Right. So after that happened, how long did you and your agent work on the manuscript in terms of polishing it? And how long were you out on submission for as you were waiting to hear back?
So my agent and I worked on revisions for about a month, I want to say. And from the time of signing with her to going on sub was about 6 weeks between edits and putting together a submission list. And we were out on submission. I was out on submission for a month total. I was out on submission for about a week before we started getting interest in setting up phone calls. The book actually went to auction. And I signed with the editor who I felt her vision matched my vision most closely. And it happened to be my editor at Putnam, which I know that it's sort of weird to be a fan of a specific imprint, but I love Putnam. I've always loved Putnam so much, and I'm just a really big fan of their list. I'd actually written down to try and keep myself motivated while I was drafting, like, I wrote down on a piece of paper, you're going to finish this novel this summer, and then you're going to sell it to Putnam. And I did. So I just felt so thrilled that things aligned in that way. But yeah, that was, the auction was on December 1st, I believe. And we went on sub November 2nd. So about a month.
Wow. One, I'm so glad for you that did not take long. I've been out on sub before for like 6 months and it's hell. It's really hell. So I'm so glad for you that yours was not long, that there was so much interest. And I agree. I absolutely adore Putnam. They published my first two novels. A shout out to everybody who works there. The publicists are incredible. The editors are incredible. It's really just a wonderful, wonderful publisher. And I'm just so thrilled for you that you've had such incredible success there. Right. So jumping off of that, Welcome Home, Caroline Klein is both a love story, but it's also a family story, and it's categorized as women's fiction. Now, anyone who listens to the podcast knows how we feel about the term women's fiction, but it is what it is until we can come up with something better. So how did genre factor into how you approached writing the novel and how you went about querying agents in terms of positioning it and pitching to the right agents?
So I share everybody's sentiment around women's fiction, but yes, for the sake of this conversation, we're going to keep it women's fiction. So genre was not top of mind for me when I was initially drafting the book. Again, this wasn't my first time writing a book, but it was my first time writing long form fiction. And, you know, your podcast had not yet come into my life. So I wasn't thinking about genre as much as I think about it now. I was more concerned, I think, with how I wanted to make readers feel and sort of the general vibes. And because I'd been writing nonfiction personal essays for a decade before I started writing Welcome Home, Caroline Klein, shifting to fiction was really that big switch for me. So genre came more into play when I started querying. I'd finished the book and it turned out to be, you know, a funny novel with a love story. So I described it in some of these early query letters as a rom-com, or I would, you know, query agents who had sports romances on their manuscript wish list. And I now know that this was a rookie mistake. I didn't understand the full picture of what defines romance as a genre and you know, rom-com as a subgenre. And you and I know this, the listeners know this. Romance readers are the savviest readers on earth, right? Like, they're keeping the lights on at all the publishing houses. They know exactly what they want. They know when in the book they need things to happen. And so I really needed to understand more about that genre and needed to understand the sort of fine line between rom-com and women's fiction. So I sort of pivoted there and then continued to query it as upmarket women's fiction in most of the subsequent cases. And I don't describe my book as rom-com anymore, obviously, because there are very specific tropes and expectations associated with the genre. But I do think that there's a chance that rom-com readers will find something that they love in Welcome Home, Caroline Klein. In describing it now, I like to say that it's a love story and not a romance, because there's a lot of family and friend and romantic love in it. And there's some self-love in there too.
Yeah, I love all of that. And it is so important to know your genre. And, you know, if you start off in pitching to the wrong people, of course you're going to get rejections because it's not what they want. And as you say, romance readers, they know exactly what they want. And if you're not giving it to them, they get really upset. I mean, I know this because somewhere along the line, my last novel, The Witches of Moonshine Manor, somewhere in the metadata, some data analyst on Amazon wrote that it was a rom-com. And so, you know, the book was selling to rom-com readers who were not having it, and they were quite upset in their reviews. And I don't blame them, because I was like, this book is not a rom-com. And no wonder they're upset about that. So it is important to know what genre you're writing, and it is important to know who your reader is going to be, because they're the ones who pick up books in this genre. And it's important to know where on the bookshelf in a bookstore your book is going to be alongside which authors. In terms of something you just said now, you said upmarket women's fiction. And I know our listeners sometimes get stuck on that. They're like, well, what's the difference between, you know, women's fiction and upmarket women's fiction? For you, what was that distinguishing characteristic? Was it an elevation of the work? Was it that it could be more book clubbish? How did you distinguish that?
I think that I'm still trying to figure this out, but there's so many good explainers online. I know that Carly has put out a really great sort of breakdown of the difference between literary, upmarket, and commercial that I, you know, of course, listeners, if you haven't seen that yet, definitely check that out. I think that when I was at the point of querying and when I sort of positioned this book as upmarket, which I stand by, and I do think that it's upmarket, I think that the best explanation that I've heard that really resonates with me is a commercial concept with a more literary execution. As I just admitted, I was not really familiar with rom-com and romance as a genre. Like, I've always read a lot of literary fiction. So that's sort of what I try to, I guess, emulate when writing. I try for like a more literary approach, but the concept of this novel and the concept of, you know, novel ideas I have to come are definitely more commercial concepts. So it really strikes that nice balance between, you know, I want the language to be elevated. Like, I want to continue to go after a more literary execution because that's the kind of writing that compels me most. But I'm very interested in those sort of like commercial concepts and commercial hooks. So I think it's really just about finding that kind of sweet spot. I also think that there's like the book club of it all. And you know, there's certainly topics in my novel that feel like book club fodder that I think that can also kind of come to define what's upmarket. It's like, are there topics in here that folks are going to be eager to discuss and disagree about when they're talking about them in a book club-esque setting as well?
Yeah. And when a publisher brings a book out sort of now, you know, it's not theoretically a summer read. They're not envisioning it as a lying on the beach kind of summer read, but it is a build up to summer and could potentially be a summer read. So they clearly saw this book as having, you know, crossover appeal, like you say, to the rom-com readers, to the women's fiction readers, to the upmarket readers, and the summer readers, which is all incredible. You've spoke earlier about personal essays, and this is the one part that I really struggle with every time I have a book come out, because I want to work as hard as I can with my publicists to do everything I can to make their jobs as easy as possible in terms of placing the book, you know, placing essays, getting people to know about the books, etc. But I suck at the personal essay. It is something I've practiced and I really just really, really suck at it. Did you find that being able to write personal essays was a plus for you when it came time for them to pitch essays to different publications? Or was that not something that really helped in the build up with the marketing campaign?
I honestly, God bless my publicist, Kristen, because I came into that marketing meeting so hot. I work in marketing as my day job, and I love to write personal essays. So meeting with my marketing team and my publicity team, I'm like, we are either going to be like best friends and iconic collaborators, or I am just going to annoy the shit out of you. So I'm very grateful that they welcomed me as a collaborator with open arms. I definitely came to the table with a lot of personal essay ideas. We're still in the process of placing some of those concepts. I want to say that it is a benefit and that it does help, but at the same time, I'm a little bit like, I have too many essay ideas for this, and there's too many directions this could go, and I have a hard time picking or focusing, if that makes sense. There's just too many. This book feels so close to me and so personal because it is my debut, that there's so many different directions that it could go. I think I ended up pitching like 8 or 10 different essay concepts to my publicist, and she's like, let's narrow it down to like 2 or 3. So I definitely can overwhelm myself in that way. But yes, I do think that at the end of the day, like, it is a benefit. And I actually bought a book. You interviewed the author on this podcast called Writing That Gets Noticed. And I bought that book when I was working on some of the personal essays that we pitched for, you know, the promotion of this novel. So I recommend that if your listeners haven't already checked that out. That was a great craft book.
Yeah, wonderful. Shout out to Estelle Erasmus, who wrote Writing That Gets Noticed. Really an incredible book. And yeah, wow, Courtney, your whole journey to publication, the whole process has been absolutely fascinating. I'm so looking forward to sharing your query letter with our Substack subscribers. Before our time is up, you know, what nuggets of wisdom do you have? What advice do you have for aspiring novelists? Because I think getting over those 75 rejections is probably the toughest part of the process. So many writers give up along the way. They just can't deal with it for mental health reasons, whatever the reasons are, and it is extremely tough. So what's your advice?
I think that your listeners already know this, but I'll just say it again. Building your community is absolutely essential. Publishing is a long game. Writing is a long game. And even if you're surrounded by the most supportive friends and family, no one is going to exactly get it like your writer friends get it. I always say that my writing friends are my favorite friends because we just get each other on a different level. I will also say, you know, be absolutely relentless in carving out time for yourself to write. I think that my relentlessness is, you know, the quality about me that has allowed me to move forward and move down this path. I think that confidence is really built when you keep a promise to yourself. So set the goal, hit the word count, keep your own promises until you finish what you set out to do. Because consistency and accountability is really key here. And, you know, no one is going to demand that time for you. You have to be merciless in taking your own time seriously. And, you know, regarding rejection, I feel comfortable being very candid about rejection, specifically on this podcast, because again, I think that the people who listen to this podcast are truly my people, because I listen to this podcast. And I will say that when I was dealing with such an onslaught of rejection earlier on in the process, I, you know, was seeking kind of like small, tangible things to help combat that feeling. So I have just like a couple of things that I did when the rejections were taking a toll on my mental health that I'd love to share with listeners. It's nothing revolutionary, but I did write myself a letter about everything in my life that was good and going right. And I included like a little pep talk about how this part of the process is just a character building experience. And one day it'll be a story that I tell. And that's true. I'm telling the story right now. And I have that letter to myself on the side of my refrigerator. It's still there.
I love that. Love it. Carry on.
I also recommend downloading the audiobook version of Elizabeth Gilbert's Big Magic and going for a walk somewhere beautiful and listening to it. It doesn't matter if it's cold out. I would bundle up, go listen. I listened to that over the course of a week when I was having a tough time. And it really, I don't know, it really like reinvigorated me. So I love that book. And of course, please listen to Bianca when she says that all it takes is one yes. You are always one yes away from your life changing. I listened to this podcast and, you know, would cry in my car when I was querying. And now some of the authors who were interviewed here ended up being the authors who blurbed my book. Some of the authors who I've listened to on this podcast have become friends. I listened to an author on here years ago and just, I went out dancing with her last Friday in Los Angeles. So all of that felt so far away to me, like as recently as a couple of years ago. And now I'm an author with a 2-book deal and my debut hit the US Today bestseller list yesterday. So if you're listening to this, I know how discouraging some of the process can be. And I know how it feels to be clouded by doubt, but I hope that you'll keep going anyway. I see this for you and I want this for you and I'm rooting for you.
What an excellent place to finish. Thank you so, so much, Courtney. We are just thrilled for you. For our listeners, we're linking to Welcome Home Caroline Klein on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you get the book there, you support an independent bookstore. If you can support East City Bookshop in the process, we would absolutely love that. But you will also support the podcast and Courtney. Courtney, we can't wait to have you back for the next book.
Thank you so much for having me, Bianca.
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a 1-month language course. Think about the cost of 1-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That we want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Hello, listeners. This is Cece. Question for you. What do all the very best stories have in common? The ability to make us feel. Which is why learning how to weave emotions into your writing is so important. And I am so excited to announce that I am teaching my super popular writing emotion class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, August 8th. At 8 p.m. Eastern Time via Zoom to learn all about the craft of writing emotions, common mistakes, tips and tricks, and lots of practical examples from novels and memoirs you love. Then we'll meet again on Monday, August 12th for a live cozy Q&A session in which you will have the option to turn on your camera and ask questions in real time. If you can't attend one or both sessions live, make sure to sign up because everyone who is registered before August 8th will get recordings 24 hours later. For more information, head to my Instagram profile and click on the link in my bio. I hope to see you there.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another comps segment where we have the fabulous Emily Summer joining us from East City Bookshop to go over all your comp requests. Now, this is the last one we are doing until the fall. We will be taking a break. We need a break. Emily needs a break. If you do have comp requests, you're going to have to wait until August until you get those in. But Emily, welcome back.
Thank you so much. It is always my pleasure to be here.
And we love chatting with you. Right, let's dive in. Here is our first one.
I'd love some comps for my speculative novel set in an alternate version of the 1970s, where everyone travels by stepping through woven tapestries. Cars do not exist. The story, told in close third single-person POV, centers on a young American woman who travels to England to study weaving at a respected college and gets sucked into trying to solve the almost two-decade-old murder of her wealthy roommate's mother, who was a famous tapestry designer, while encountering great works of art, forming relationships, and having a fair amount of not-graphic sex along the way. I think the book shares vibes with art world mysteries like B.A. Shapiro's The Art Forger or Dominic Smith's The Last Painting of Sarah DeVos, though both books are a little old at this point. But I'm struggling to comp the speculative aspect of the tapestries as transportation, especially considering there are no other magic or fantasy elements in my book, as well as the matriarchal and feminist undertones. Any help would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
So I say it every month, but people get better and better about coming up with their own comps. So I absolutely would have suggested the Sarah DeVos, the Dominic Smith. I think that's a great one. I agree. It is a little old, but we're on the same page. We're on the right track. As far as a more recent portal fantasy that I think would work here, I would look at Piranesi by Susanna Clarke. Big, but hopefully not too big. You could also look at other things that Susanna Clarke has recommended as a result of Piranesi. You know, the authors are asked to recommend books and they blur books that are similar to their books. So that could be at least a jumping off point. And then for the weaving element, I would look at A Single Thread by Tracy Chevalier. It is a book about embroidery, not weaving, but it is a fairly recent one of hers. It is, I think, the most recent one. There's one coming out this year. I think it's the most recent one right before that. And because it is about embroidery, it does incorporate that craftsmanship and that artistry. If we're ever talking about a book about textiles, I have to mention the nonfiction book, The Golden Thread by Cassia St. Clair. This is a book that sells steadily for us. She also wrote a wonderful book called The Secret Lives of Color. But I think that even though this is nonfiction, I think The Golden Thread might tie into the matriarchal and feminist undertones that you mention, because it is an investigation of how important and significant something is, even when it was considered women's work. So I would look at Piranesi, A Single Thread, and The Golden Thread and go from there. Hopefully one of those will help a little bit.
Thank you, Emily. Here's number two.
I'm looking for comp titles for my upmarket cozy mystery with the working title, Here Lies. Wren Metcalf is a cardiac surgery intern who is thrust back into her small hometown in Georgia for the first time in 9 years to investigate the mysterious death of her grandmother. Despite the platitudes from friends and family, Ren's medical knowledge causes her to question whether her lively, albeit demented grandmother simply died in her sleep. In efforts to avoid the gossip around her return and the scandals that prompted her escape in the first place, Ren wanders the halls of the nursing home where her grandmother resided and finds camaraderie in the current residents who corroborate her suspicion. The only problem is, their memories are less than reliable, and someone in the nursing home is catching on to Ren's investigations, sending threatening letters if she doesn't give it up. Throughout her time back home, Ren is forced to reflect on the choices she's made, the lies she's told, and the people she's lost in the process, including herself. This story, in its essence, urges readers to reckon with the questions, when does life begin, when does it end, and how much does it matter if there's nothing in the middle? I had considered The Sicilian Inheritance by Joe Piazza.
So this one cut off, just as you mentioned, The Sicilian Inheritance. And I see where you're going with that one, because that one is precipitated by a death in the family. There are family secrets. There are mystery elements. However, I would say no as a comp based on just this very limited voicemail information. But I think of The Sicilian Inheritance and the way I have seen it selling in our store is very much as armchair travel and commercial fiction and not as a cozy mystery. So I think that the real hook of that is the Sicily piece and the Italian setting. When I hear the description of this one and I hear nursing home as a partial setting and I hear cozy mystery, I immediately think of Richard Osman's Thursday Murder Club. I think that is too big right now because let me tell you, we cannot keep it on the shelf, any of the books. I just have to keep ordering more and more copies so that we do not sell out. Instead, I will recommend what I recommend to customers in the shop who are finished with Thursday Murder Club and want something similar. And that's a book by Robert Thorogood called The Marlowe Murder Club. And that also has the element of being sort of a lighthearted mystery. It has older characters, such as our character is finding now that she's returning back to her town and she's in the nursing home. So I think that that one could be a good one. That one also is selling very well for us. This vibe, this like sort of cozier mystery is definitely what people are looking for right now. And then as for the aspect of a protagonist returning home after a death or dealing with the death of a relative, and what does that mean for their own identity, maybe consider Linda Holmes's book, Flying Solo. Not a mystery at all, but it might have some of the same character-driven figuring oneself out, what makes a life, what's important in a life. It might have those vibes, and that could pair well with the mystery.
Thank you, Emily. Number three.
Hi, I'm hoping you can help me find comps for my book, which is women's fiction. It centers on Fabiola Butler, a Brooklyn mother of three who is the breadwinner of her family with her home organization business while her husband struggles to sell his startup. When Fabiola volunteers to be a surrogate for her best friend Liz, she tells herself it's because she wants to help her friend, not because she still has feelings for Liz's husband, Peter. But when an impulsive encounter with Peter leaves Fabiola wondering whose baby she's carrying, Liz's or her own, she has to decide what to hold on to and what's worth sacrificing. Fabiola's long-absent mother also reappears in her life just as she's questioning what motherhood and family truly mean. I'm struggling to find comps that capture the book's themes of a protagonist struggling with having made a huge mistake of the moral kind and of a woman struggling with the mental load of society's expectations of motherhood and marriage. Thanks for your help.
Okay, so I immediately thought of one of my favorites in recent years, The Paper Palace by Miranda Cowley Heller, because that is also a book that starts with a shocking moment of infidelity. And then the book explores the repercussions of that moment of infidelity. So there is this moral quandary that the characters are dealing with. I also, it's probably too big, but I thought about The Dutch House by Ann Patchett because it is the book in recent years that I think has really carefully and thoughtfully explored. I mean, lots of books have, but this one carefully, thoughtfully explored society's expectations of marriage and motherhood, and arguably also deals with the repercussions of a huge moral mistake made by a mother. And then maybe Family by Lori Frankel, which is very recent. It's not about surrogacy and does not necessarily have that same moral quandary at its heart, but it is about adoption and it is about very complicated family dynamics. So depending on the tone, that one could work as well.
What do you think about Claire Lombardo's Same As It Ever Was? Is it maybe too literary for this?
Oh, no, that could be good too. Yeah, I mean, that one, so this one has like questions of surrogacy and a pregnancy, but I think that's a really great one too. Any chance to shout out Claire as well?
Yeah.
Be on the lookout for Same As It Ever Was. Yeah, that's an excellent suggestion.
That'll be out in June, I think. So, and yeah. Listen out for that interview. We have interviewed her for the podcast, so you will hear that.
It's so good. Oh, it's so good.
We spoke about you actually on the podcast, Emily, so your ears will be burning.
Well, I'll have to listen.
Yeah. Okay, here we go. Number four.
Hi, thank you to the Shit No One Tells You team for these amazing bonus episodes with Emily. I'm looking for help with comps for my 88,000 word multi-POV upmarket mystery thriller with a madcap edge. It's about a trio of teacher chaperones dealing with disappearing kids on an eighth grade trip. While trying to reclaim the missing kids, they discover their school's leadership is involved in financial fraud. Worse, they could be at the root of why the kids are gone. When the trip's largely absent fourth chaperone is found dead, the chaperones run the risk of paying the price for others' crimes unless they find the kids and uncover the truth behind their school's corruption. If Abbott Elementary and National Treasure had a baby, it would be my book. It also shares the take down the bad boss vibes of Chandler Baker's The Whisper Network and Camille Perry's The Assistants, but without the Me Too or profiteering employees. Thanks so much, Emily, for any ideas you have.
All right. You have me at the Abbott Elementary meets National Treasure. I don't know how you could do any better than that. I love it. I'm laughing already. I'm completely sold. I also am sold because of the eighth grade field trip aspect of it. I don't know if it's set in DC, but it seems like every eighth grader in the country comes to DC on a spring break trip. So I have visions of these masses of eighth graders, hopefully none of whom are having problems as described in this voicemail. But anyway, I'm here for this mystery. I love a madcap thriller. When I am thinking of mysteries with a madcap edge, I immediately think of and recommend Lisa Lutz. So her series, The Spellman Files, is legitimately funny, definitely madcap. It's old, but she does have more recent ones, so I would investigate those. They might fit the bill. Her most recent is The Accomplice, which I think came out in hardcover in 2022. I think it's less madcap than The Spellman Files, but it's also more recent, so that's good. But she just has a very, very witty voice. So check out Lisa Lutz. I think she's fantastic. All right, an older one that I think is too old to be a really successful comp, but I have to mention it here because it's so funny. It's just a heck of a lot of fun, and it's called Dear Daughter by Elizabeth Little, and I have described that one as Paris Hilton joins Scooby-Doo's mystery gang. There are no talking dogs, but it is truly zany and hilarious, but also a very good mystery. So I think it's hard to find that balance, and Dear Daughter was a really good one. For a mystery about school corruption, there's a brand new YA book with major adult appeal because I read it and loved it. It's called Promise Boys by Nick Brooks, and that is set at a DC charter school. So I had particular local interest to me, but I think it's a really good book for anybody. But that's about school corruption. There's a book called The Gifted School by Bruce Holsinger, which came out a few years ago, that is a satire about schools and parents and privilege and entitlement. If any of those elements are present in the plot, I would suggest looking at The Gifted School, which is a lot of fun. And again, not as a comp, but I have to mention it because it has such a hilarious field trip scene. It's Early Morning Riser by Katherine Heine. Not a mystery at all, just very funny literary fiction. But there is a scene in Early Morning Riser where the main character, a teacher, takes her class to a farm, and it had me rolling. So I want everybody to read that just because it's so good. But anyway, Abbott Elementary meets National Treasure. Done. You're in it.
Byron Lane in his last one also had a very funny perspective of a field trip on a farm, but that was from the mother of the groom-to-be's perspective, and that was also hilarious.
Oh, I had forgotten that. Yes, big gay wedding. Yes, that's a great one too.
Okay, here we go, number five.
Hi, my name is Kelly, and first off, as always, just a quick thanks to the podcast and Emily for doing these comp segments. I called in last month, but Emily asked for a little bit more information, specifically the cause of death for one of the characters, so I'll repeat a little of what I said last time for summary and include some more details. I'm looking for comps for my contemporary dual POV novel. It follows 30-something twin sisters in Chicago. In the current timeline, we follow Clark, who is grieving her sister Abigail's death. They were hit by a drunk driver, but Clark blames herself because she's the reason her sister was in the car that night, Now, a month later, she's struggling to finish her paintings for an upcoming gallery show that she needs to complete in order to pay rent and fulfill her contract. She starts spending time with a neighbor who helps pull her from her grief, and eventually life seems bearable. But next, fiance comes back into the picture and she fears he'll expose a secret she's been hiding from the night of the accident and ruin the new life she's created. In the past timeline, we follow Abigail in the months before the accident while she navigates a new relationship and her fight for a promotion at her male-dominated law firm. The sister's dynamic is similar to that of Practical Magic, but I've really been struggling to find any comps, so any ideas are greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Hi, Kelly. Thank you very much for listening and for calling in. Thank you for calling back with more information. That does help, and I do have a couple of suggestions. So my first suggestion is Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance by Allison Esbach. It is not a dual POV because it's just the surviving sister, but it is an absolutely brilliant book about sisterly grief and guilt and surviving after you have lost a sister. It's one of my favorite books of recent years, and I cannot recommend it highly enough. Allison Esbach also has a book coming out next month. It's this summer. It's called The Wedding People. Nothing to do with sisters, but another brilliant novel. The next one I'll recommend is Like Mother, Like Daughter by Kimberly McCrate, which is coming out soon. And it is a mother-daughter situation instead of sisters, but it has a similar dual POV. It has flashbacks leading up to the precipitating event. It is secrets surrounding what really happened, complicated family dynamics. So I think even though it's not a sister story, it could have other similarities that might work. Another book that is coming up soon, which I absolutely loved, is called Bear by Julia Phillips. She wrote Disappearing Earth, which got a lot of attention a few years ago. Another absolutely wonderful sister story. You only get one sister's POV, but it is one that is so good and so unique that it's always going to be in the upper echelon of like sister stories that I recommend to people. So be on the lookout for that soon. And then another one that just came out is called April, May, June, July by Allison B. Hart, who also wrote the wonderful Work Wife a couple of years ago. And April, May, June, July is multi-POV. It's four siblings, not two sisters, but you hear from all the sisters. And in this case, it is following their father's disappearance, but it has sort of the what happened, how were we left. There's a lot of guilt. There's a lot of returning to what happened before leading up to the dad's disappearance, what's happening to all of the siblings now. Just came out this week, and I want everybody to be aware of that one as well.
I love the books you've just mentioned because the three of them, we're either interviewing the authors on the podcast coming up or they're writing for our newsletter. So everybody make sure you subscribe to the newsletter or listening to upcoming episodes. Another great book here, but I know it's way too old, is one of my favorite authors, Julia Glass. She wrote a book called I See You Everywhere. It was multi-POV. It was sisters. It was incredible, but that came out in like 2008. So it's going to be too old, but a great book to read anyway.
I have forgotten about her, but she is wonderful.
Oh yeah. She's just incredible. Okay. Here we go. Number six.
Hi, I'm looking for comps for my dual POV YA paranormal horror novel set in the 80s with music, especially metal, but also Bowie, as a big part of both plot and atmosphere. Teens in a small town in upstate New York are attacked by a malevolent force on a heavy metal cassette. Then dogs start to go missing and a beloved friend dies by a baffling suicide. Our protagonist is invited to be the opening act for the band on that tape in 1 week, a show they discover will be a ritual sacrifice of the audience. Stranger Things is my non-book comp, and it's too old and big, but It by Stephen King, the kids' timeline, is definitely a great grandparent of this book. I have Adam Cesar's Clown in a Cornfield for its 80s horror film vibe. My book gets violent, but it's not a slasher, so that's not perfect. Also, Emily Henry's When the Sky Fell in Splendor for the tight small-town friend group dealing with unexplainable weirdness. Any help appreciated. Thanks.
Oh, I love this one because I have a bunch of suggestions right off the bat. I am not a paranormal fan, but I am always here for the 80s and any of the like metal, Bowie, 80s satanic panic, heavy metal, all of this, all the vibes. I'm here for all the vibes. I think Stranger Things is a great one. So I'm glad you mentioned that. That also helps me with the comps that I'm about to give. And one of those, whenever I hear, sometimes I'll get teens that come in and they're like, I don't really like to read. And so I'll ask, what do you like to watch or what do you like to do? And if they mention Stranger Things, I recommend Craig Davidson's The Saturday Night Ghost Club. It is adult. We shelve it in adult, but definite YA crossover appeal. I've had people who think it's YA. I think it appeals to both. Very much Stranger Things vibes in terms of an 80s pack of kids. And as the title says, there are ghosts. So for sure, Saturday Night Ghost Club by Craig Davidson. I would absolutely look at Grady Hendrix's books. Very 80s, very good horror standards, pop culture influenced. I think maybe My Best Friend's Exorcism might be the closest, but I would look at all of Grady Hendrix's books and see which fits the bill the most. More recent than My Best Friend's Exorcism is Gone to the Wolves by John Ray. That's another adult book, and it's not horror, but it is the most heavy metal 1980s cults friendship story that I can think of. So I think you'll want to look at that. And for similar sort of 80s metal vibes, I would look at Devil House by John Darnielle, Rainbow Black by Maggie Thrash, which just came out. And it's too old and she's too big. But if you haven't read Dark Places by Gillian Flynn, that one's got that sort of 80s metal vibe as well. And I really liked that one. I read it before Gone Girl came out and it made me a Gillian Flynn fan.
Thank you, Emily. Yes. Shout out to Craig Davidson, who is a Canadian author. Feeling very sad this week after the news of Alice Munro, but let's not get into that. Just be weepy.
Yes. An icon. Icons only. The best. Yeah.
Okay. Number 7.
Thanks so much for your comps for my 80,000 word multi-POV historical novel inspired by the real life executioner's family during the French Revolution. Disenfranchised idealist Henri yearns to practice law, but instead must inherit the executioner legacy from his monarchist father, Charles. When revolution erupts, Henri enlists to fight, disavowing his family and relegating his devout younger brother, Gabriel, to apprentice. Furious with Henri and desperate to pay off hostile creditors, a bankrupt Charles reluctantly accepts a project from the new revolutionary government to invent an equitable, reliable, and painless killing machine, La Guillotine. Meanwhile, amidst increasingly treacherous political chaos, counter-revolutionary Gabriel sneaks persecuted clergy out of Paris in a clandestine operation helmed by his secret beloved, Henri's estranged fiancé. As the revolutionary leaders Henri idolizes begin denouncing each other, he becomes ensnared in the dark side of democracy. The lines between freedom and tyranny, innocence and guilt begin to blur. No one is safe. As familial betrayals turn deadly and loved ones lose their heads, a disillusioned Henri must make the ultimate sacrifice to end the carnage and save his family and the nation from itself.
This one sounds incredible. It sounds so incredible that the first authors I think of are authors that are too big to be useful. And those are authors like Hilary Mantel, Maggie O'Farrell, Ken Follett, none of whom I think are useful for a debut author querying. So some more recent, not as big books. The Glutton by A.K. Blakemore is a book that came out, I believe, last year. It's recent and it's set in the French Revolution. So look at that as historical fiction that might fit what you're looking for. And then two by Alison Epstein that have, I think, done well and may have that historical thriller literary fiction that you're looking for. And her books are Let the Dead Bury the Dead. That's the most recent one. And that one takes place in Russia post-Napoleon. And her previous book, A Tip for the Hangman, which is England in the Mary Queen of Scots era. So even though the setting is not the same, I think the family strife, the political intrigue, the historical, deadly historical stakes, I think those might work.
Thank you, Emily. Okay, number 8.
Hi, Emily. I'm looking for comps for my late coming-of-age memoir, part love story, part complicated mother-daughter relationship, On the Pacific Crest Trail. It's Cheryl Strayed's Wild, which I know I can't comp, meets a steamy romance. When I was 22, my mom and I shuttered the small business we owned, posting a sign on the building that read, "Be back in 2,655 miles. The plan? To realize our shared dream of walking from Mexico to Canada on the Pacific Crest Trail. Leaving my high school sweetheart at home waiting for me, I set out on this last adventure before settling down to the 2.5 kids and a dog life I had planned. Then, 300 miles into the trip, I'm introduced to a handsome hiker, trail name Turbo. Though I am desperate to remain loyal to my boyfriend, I can't stop the pull I feel toward Turbo. When my mom discovers my infatuation, she says that she will tell my boyfriend if I cheat on him. Despite her warning, I begin an affair with Turbo and attempt to hide it from mom while sharing a tent with her. As the three of us traverse the Mojave Desert and the Sierra Nevada mountains, I fall deeper into my obsession with Turbo and the tension between mom and I builds, exposing deep fissures in our once close relationship. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a shame that you can't use Wild because it seems perfect, but it is too big, too old. But anytime there's a book set on the PCT, we're all automatically going to think about Wild. Instead, maybe look at Deep Creek by Pam Houston. You can look at all of her books. She writes both fiction and essays. And I thought of Pam Houston because she writes books about nature and sort of adventuring and traveling, but with a real core of like thoughtful humanness and like, what does this mean for me? And how is this going to affect my life when I go back into the real world? I often suggest what I think is probably too old, but it's one of my favorite memoirs, and that's Ariel Levy's The Rules Do Not Apply, for a memoir about being in a foreign place or a strange place and having that experience and what you're experiencing there upending your life. But I think it's probably too old, but man, it's a great book. The Rules Do Not Apply. Maybe Slightly Too Old is another PCT memoir of self-discovery that could work in the place of Wild. And it's Girl in the Woods by Aspen Mattis. And that one is Crest Trail specific. And then one with a completely different setting, but is also sort of woman out on her own figuring things out, is Rough Magic by Laura Pryor Palmer. And that's set when she undertook a long distance horse race across Mongolia. So not the Pacific Crest Trail from, you know, Mexico to Canada, but another major cross-country voyage. I don't know specifically about the mother-daughter piece, but I feel like it's pretty easy to find like complicated mother-daughter relationship books, fiction or memoir. So I feel like if you can find kind of an adventure memoir angle, you can find something else that'll cover that mother-daughter piece.
Wonderful. Thank you. Okay, number 9.
Thank you for this amazing service, Emily. My book is a middle grade portal fantasy. It's kind of the unruly grandchild of The Phantom Tollbooth, which I know would need some newer comps to supplement it. It's about an 11-year-old aspiring comedian who runs his mouth about everything except for how much he misses his best friend who just moved away. When he acts out in English class, his teacher banishes him to a fantasy world that's based on grammar. It's his worst nightmare. But he slowly warms to the idea that language isn't just for zingers, it's also for giving voice to how lonely he is without his friend. In addition, there's some zany action, like when he gets on the wrong side of the law being, of course, the grammar police. Dun dun. A few not quite right comps that I'm considering are Stand Up Yumi Chung for its comedian protagonist and The Anti-Book for its meta qualities. I'm especially looking for recent middle grade books that mix irreverence with uncomfortable emotions and are not high fantasy. Thank you so much for your time.
Yes, absolutely. To Stand Up Yumi Chung. As soon as I heard 11-year-old aspiring comedian, I thought about Yumi Chung. We love that book. So I think that's absolutely one to mention. When I'm thinking about kind of an irreverent, funny book dealing with uncomfortable emotions, there are two recent middle grade books that I think could work really well here. The first is Simon Sort of Says by Aaron Bow, B-O-W. And that is a child who is dealing with significant trauma, but is legitimately, the book is legitimately funny. So I hope that it strikes that right balance, because it is definitely, it has that irreverence, but there are real issues and real emotional difficulties at play. Likewise, I would suggest The Insiders by Mark Oshiro, which also balances real emotion, real discomfort, but with a lot of humor and heart. And as a bonus, that one has a portal fantasy element as well. So I think it's a good one.
Thank you, Emily. Okay, we're now at halfway, number 10.
Hey, Bianca and Emily, thanks for your help. I'm looking for comps for my domestic thriller about Maren Murphy, a single mom and former painter who receives a mysterious letter from a woman claiming to have information about her past. Normally, Maren would dismiss it, but when the woman's body is found, she feels like she can't ignore it. Meanwhile, financial hardship sends Maren and her young daughter back to her childhood home, a fictional agricultural town in Northern California that she fled decades ago. Now she must confront her turbulent relationship with her mother, her unresolved grief over her father's death, and an important friendship she abandoned. All the while, she's moving closer to solving the woman's mysterious letter, the fallout of which bears on every part of her life, her fractured relationship to art, her romance with an old high school acquaintance, and everything she understands about family and identity. For comps, the cryptic note is reminiscent of The Last Thing He Told Me. For the return to hometown and complex family dynamics, sharp objects make sense, but neither of these feels usable. And for the fraught relationship to art, I'm at a loss. Thanks so much.
I love where you're going with The Last Thing He Told Me and sharp objects, although I think you're right that those are too big. I am reading a book now, and I wish that I mean, as much as I love doing this, I sure would love to be curled up finishing Tell Me Who You Are by Louisa Luna. And that one does not start with a cryptic note, but it does start with a cryptic message and a resulting missing person and a main character who has to deal with secrets from the past. So the specifics are different, but the vibes might be the same. And it is excellent. I think Louisa Luna is so good. She has written a series about like a bounty hunter named Alice Vega. This is a standalone and it comes out in just a couple of weeks. So Tell Me Who You Are by Louisa Luna. I hope that it will do really well because it deserves to. It's excellent. I also thought about When the Stars Go Dark by Paula McLean, which I loved. And that is a book that has some similarities about returning home, dealing with your past secrets in the context of a recent ongoing mystery. It also shares that Northern California setting. So I think that that one could be a nice mention, also a really good book. And then because of the cryptic note, I just have to mention a book that I don't think sounds like a comp at all, but it's so, so, so good. And that's The Postcard by Anne Barrest. And this is just me using any excuse to recommend The Postcard. It just came out in paperback. And the postcard of the title is a mysterious postcard that the main character and her mother received in 2005. No return address, no context. It's just the names of their family members who were killed in the Holocaust. And they have to figure out, why is this sent? Is it a threat? What's happening? This is historical fiction because you get the story of the family during World War II, as well as the story of what's the deal with this mysterious postcard. But I hear a cryptic note and I've got to recommend Anne Barrest because it's just that good.
Thank you, Emily. Okay, number 11.
Hi, I'm Lauren, and I'm looking for comps for my fiction novel with a speculative twist, Chippy. It's told from the POV of a mother, Dina, and her son Dominic's imaginary friend, Chippy. When Dina's husband, Andrew, leaves, she's determined to make a stable life for her and her son without him. She goes back to her old demanding job in advertising and is promised stability if she can help the company win a big pitch. With her working nonstop, Chippy helps Dominic make a plan to get his old life back, but the plan is derailed when Dominic is diagnosed with a chronic illness. I have considered Someone Else's Shoes for the dual POV and themes, as well as the show Wilfred for the imaginary friend and dark humor, but I'm really at a loss for something similar. I'm so grateful for any help you can give. Thank you.
Chippy sounds singular, so I thought maybe Chippy is going to stump me because I haven't been asked about an imaginary friend narrator before. The first thing I thought of is maybe Remarkably Bright Creatures by Shelby Van Pelt, which I tend to think is too big because we keep selling it in the bookstore. Although one of the reasons we keep selling it is because people keep coming in and have never heard of it. So maybe it's not as big out there as I think that it is. And I thought of that one because one of the narrators of Remarkably Bright Creatures is a very bright octopus named Marcellus, which turned me off of the book at first. And then I came all the way around and now I love octopuses because Marcellus is just that cool. Similarly, a slightly older book, Hollow Kingdom by Kira Jane Buxton. The narrator there is a crow and there is lots of dark humor. So you have the speculative twist of the unusual narrator, very dark, funny humor. The plot is very different, but the narrator angle could be similar enough to make it work. And then I thought of both of Annie Hartnett's books, Rabbit Cake, which came out from, I think, Ten House, maybe in 2017, so maybe too old, but her book Unlikely Animals is more recent. And in Rabbit Cake, it is a young person dealing with their grief over the loss of a parent. They're with a single parent. It is still very quirky. And in Unlikely Animals, there are indeed imaginary friends and or ghosts. I won't spoil it too much, but that could work.
Thank you. Okay, number 12.
Hey, everybody. You may remember me from last month's comps episode where I called in with a question about comps for my contemporary pre-apocalyptic YA coming-of-age novel. And Emily, you had recommended two books for me, At the End of the World by Nadia McHale and Under This Forgetful Sky by Lauren Yero. I'm about halfway through the McHale book right now, and it seems like it'll be a good comp, but the Yero book is a much darker tone and also way more dystopian than my book, which takes place in the contemporary real world. I did recently read what I think would be a terrific comp tone-wise, also with the themes of friendship, and does take place in the contemporary real world, which is Let's Call It a Doomsday by Katie Henry. However, it was published in 2019, and I was wondering, do you think that's too old? And if so, do you have something that is more recent yet comparable to the setting, tone, and friendship themes of that book. Thank you all so much for all you do. I super duper appreciate you.
Okay, thank you for calling back. I regret that sometimes all I've got is what I give in the first call. And I definitely don't think that all of these comps will be right without reading the books. So one of the reasons I always try to give at least two is that hopefully one of them might work or be close or lead you in a direction. So I'm glad that one was okay. Sorry about the other one. It sounds like you found something else that will work really nicely. And 2019 seems okay to me. I'm 46, so 5 years ago seems like yesterday to me. And those books still feel very fresh and new. But that is really a question for the agents. Although Bianca and I discussed this before we started recording, and she said that Carly said a 2019 book was okay on a recent Books with Hooks segment. So we think 2019 sounds good. And I'll also say, just when it comes to looking for more comp requests, as I know all of you are, I often get comp requests from customers in our store. And some of those are people who listen to the podcast who know that I do this and love to do this. But a lot of them are not customers who listen to the podcast. They are just aspiring writers who are looking for comps the way you all are. Of course, my first recommendation is always, you've got to listen to the shit no one tells you about writing. And they're always so glad for the recommendation. But I say all that just to say that your local indie bookseller might be a great resource for this. And they have the luxury of, they can spend more time hearing about your book and they can throw out some suggestions and you can send them in a different direction. So Amazon cannot do that and will not, but real life human booksellers can, especially if you're going to buy the books from them. Please try to do that. So I don't want to volunteer my bookselling colleagues for anything, but our job is to help you find the books that you need for whatever reason that you need them. And comp titles could be one of those reasons. So I urge people to visit their local indie bookstores and see if anybody can help them further there.
I echo that. I've never been let down by a bookseller yet. Okay, number 13.
Hi, I'm Lori, looking for comps for Marcy Makes Mistakes, a multi-POV women's fiction novel about the 80s New York art world. It's a love triangle and office romance of Bridget Jones' Diary meets 80s art scene and Mackay's Great Believers, plus New York restaurant life of Dandler's Sweet Bitter. Marcy dreams of her own New York art gallery. On track at 29, she has the perfect auction house job and perfect affair with Russell, her boss. When their affair is discovered, Marcy loses her dream job and dreamboat all at once. To stay in New York, she works in a restaurant and meets Jake. Soon they're engaged, but a tragedy before the wedding leaves Marcy betrayed and alone again. Not one to languish, she doubles down on the gallery dream. When Russell offers the chance to sign a famous female artist, Marcy has a dilemma: work with her ex and the artist, or walk away from Russell and the career-making opportunity. Meanwhile, Russell's on his own journey to leave his society wife for the only woman he's ever loved, Marcy. Will he win her back? Emily, my concern is Bridget Jones and Sweet Bitter are too old and The Great Believers is too literary. Please help. Thanks.
So I think that we answered this one back in February or March. So according to my notes, this was number 16, and I think our February recording. It was February or March. But at that time, and still now, I agree that Bridget is too old, too big. I agree that The Great Believers should be substituted. And I suggested Molly Prentice's Tuesday Nights in 1980, which is a little bit old, but very much on point. And I suggested Writers and Lovers by Lily King, one of my favorites to recommend, and Lo-Fi by Liz Riggs, which is about to come out, but that is a Sweet Bitter comp. So if you think Sweet Bitter is too old or you want something along those lines, I think Lo-Fi is a really good one.
Thank you, Emily. Number 14.
Hi, thank you so much for your help. I'm looking for comps for my adult contemporary rom-com Immediately and Without Thinking, set against the backdrop of the 2010 music industry. When 25-year-old music journalist Adeline meets celebrated music entrepreneur Jared at a music festival, it's love at first sight. He even helps her get a job at the influential music startup he works at. After their summer fling ends disastrously, they find themselves working together and old feelings reignite. A love triangle ensues between Adeline, Jared, and her boss Finn, with Adeline's slow-burning friends-to-lovers romance with Finn unfolding throughout the book. Overall, it's a lighthearted rom-com with all the tender markings of an adult coming of age. I'm thinking of using Jay-Z Jones and the Six as a comp, but seeking other music-centric titles. Lo-Fi is a potential comp, but it's unreleased, so I'm curious if you think it's a good fit. Tonally, it's similar to the dry observational humor of The Rachel Incident, but that's not a rom-com, and I'm struggling to find rom-coms that also incorporate building a career in your early 20s, particularly in a creative industry, as those are big themes in the book. Thank you so much for your help.
I say it every month. Anytime there's a music book, I'm here for any sort of music novel. It's one of my sweet spots. I would say no to Daisy Jones and the Six, despite my love of the book and my love of any sort of music novel, just because I think Daisy Jones and the Six is, one, it's too big now, probably. And two, I think it's so focused on the musicians and the behind the scenes of the singers themselves that it might not capture the music industry part. People might be looking for like the actual singers themselves. For a book about the creative industry, a new book that just came out, it's called How to End a Love Story by Yulin Kwong, and it is set in a writer's room, so it has that career angle and the creative aspect. It's set in the world of television, not in the music industry, but I think it's similar enough that it might work. In 2021, there was a book that Sourcebooks published called Love Songs for Skeptics by Christina Pashiris. And that one is music industry specific about a music journalist. So I would take a look at that one. And finally, I think that all of Jasmine Guillory's books do a really good job of talking about developing young careers. They're not music specific, but just in terms of like good romances that deal with a woman in a career, in a very impressive career, struggling, she's good at that. So I would look at Jasmine.
Also keep an eye out in September for The Lightning Bottles by Marissa Stapley, who wrote Lucky. That was the Reese's Book Club pick, first Canadian to be picked for that. That might also be a comp, but that is only coming out in September. Okay, here we go. Number 15.
My contemporary Southern fiction novel, The Anchor, is told primarily in first-person POV with third-person from two additional characters. Primetime anchor Elijah Cooper disappears after making powerful enemies and someone he cares about is murdered. Years later, he moves to Atlanta to work again, and during a bank robbery, bonds with Georgia Hadley, a recent college graduate. Elijah offers Georgia a job, but expects her to work with Will Avery, a cameraman who created publicity around Elijah's arrival that impacted Georgia. They encounter threats from a drug cartel, experience personal repercussions from their work, and share a love of baseball. At 80,000 words, The Anchor could be upmarket women's or book club fiction and includes a romance. Like Kinfolk, it showcases the South with ordinary people fighting organized crime. It shares the caretaker's themes of grief and self-sacrifice, and like The Last Exchange, it explores forgiveness and how far you would go to save someone you love. Thank you so much, Emily, for help with comps, and if you have any feedback on the title, I'd love to hear that too.
So I think you're on to some good comps with The Anchor. I like Kinfolk for the reasons that you described. Similarly, I like The Last Exchange. I think it seems like you're right on the money. I will add a suggestion for The Mysteries of Wanda Morris, who is she is always my comp when somebody wants something John Grisham-esque. Definitely Southern. Her books, Wanda Morris's books, skew more mystery than general fiction, but they are squarely set in the South with Southern characters and definitely ordinary people fighting the bad guys. So I think those similarities work. And when I hear sort of drug cartel and murder and armed robbery, I am hearing some crime or noir elements. So I'd suggest Chris Offutt. He is very good at writing Southern noir and Southern crime. So is S.A. Cosby, who I mention all the time because he's just brilliant. But the books that you've mentioned as comps are gentler than that, and I would not describe them as crime or noir. So if the ones I just suggested are too dark, I would suggest maybe for something lighter, the books by Christy Woodson Harvey. Gentler, lighter might not be the right word, but something sort of gentler. And Will Leach is a Southern author who is somewhere in between the dark noir and the gentle small town stories. So check out Will Leach too. I think he's very good.
And perhaps David Joy as well, Emily?
Yeah, along the lines of that sort of the noir. Yeah, the noir crime. I think if Chris Offutt and S.A. Cosby feel good, then David Joy is a good one too.
Okay, we've got five left. Are you ready? This has been a marathon. Okay, here we go. Number 16.
My name's Drew, and I'm seeking comps for my close third-person novel, The Creeping Ivy, a mystery adventure set in a retro-futurist world of intrigue, danger, and romance. In the lower levels of Sky City, an Art Deco metropolis floating in the clouds, private detective Virginia Eve searches for a missing husband, one of countless Offlander refugees to have recently disappeared. As the case leads her back to the aristocratic skyscrapers of privilege and heartbreak she fled years ago, Virginia discovers a secret society bent on plunging the Skyland into authoritarianism. Mixing pulp, plotting, with lyrical prose, I'm struggling to find the right comps. It's got a sci-fi twist on noir versus the fantasy of Even Though I Knew the End by C.L. Polk. It's sultry and empathetic, like Sylvia Moreno Garcia's Velvet Was the Night. And while too big to comp, it's got the gothic melodrama and yearning interiority of Sarah J. Maas, A Court of Thorns and Roses. Cinematic comps are The Maltese Falcon or Casablanca with the supernatural denouement of an Indiana Jones film. I'm hesitant to label it sci-fi as, despite the floating city and flying cars, it's grounded in an old Hollywood aesthetic of fedoras, Bertinis, and revolvers. I appreciate any titles that might help sharpen my query. Thank you.
Okay, this one is a lot. So Drew, thank you for calling in. And I'm going to try to talk about at least enough of these aspects to make it helpful for you. Because it seems like the focus is on that old Hollywood aesthetic and the sort of pulp mystery, I would suggest Jonathan Ames's Doll series. Those are sort of a descendant of Dashiell Hammett, I think. So I think that those are going to fit the vibe that you're talking about. Similarly, I think Jake Tapper's The Devil May Dance could work. That is a Hollywood Rat Pack vibes, again, with a mystery. So I think that could work. I'm hearing, it makes me think of like LA Confidential set in space. So I feel like I have to go watch the movie LA Confidential after hearing about this. I know you said you didn't really even want to focus on the sci-fi aspect of it. I think you have to. And I think the C.L. Polk that you mentioned is a good one. I will also add The Starless Crown by James Rollins, because I think the action and intrigue and the similar speculative elements, I think James Rollins might fit the bill.
Thank you. Okay, number 17.
Hi, I need help with comp titles for my dual POV women's fiction novel about a 28-year-old woman who's given up on finding love to care for her grandma, an autistic uncle, until she's accidentally transported into the past by her 33-year-old time-traveling neighbor with out-of-control abilities. The current comps are The Midnight Library for the light speculative element and the sampling of alternative lives through time travel, Ellie Hazelwood novels for the tone, and Don't Forget to Write by Sarah Goodman Campino for the generational relationships explored with wit and emotional depth. The book has themes of intergenerational relationships, familial duty, romantic love that goes beyond appearance, sacrifice, and balancing responsibility against a sense of self. Thank you so much.
I love all of these themes, and I love the comps that you have already come up with. In lieu of The Midnight Library, I maybe would suggest the Matt Haig's previous book, How to Stop Time. I don't know. It's a balance, because The Midnight Library, I think, is so big. How to Stop Time is not quite as big, but it's also older. So that's a balance and a judgment call. It is helpful to hear you mention Ellie Hazelwood for tone, and Don't Forget to Write in terms of the theme. So I like those. And I will add Welcome Home, Caroline Klein by Courtney Price, which just came out. It's a delightful, really, really well-written book set in the Jersey Shore. So a really good summer read if you're looking for one. But that book talks about striking the balance between caretaking and finding oneself, definite themes of familial duty, fulfilling one's own individual dreams. It's funny, it's romantic. So definitely check out Welcome Home, Caroline Klein. It's a great one. And also look at all of the books by Ashley Poston, because she writes romances that all have a light speculative bend. So whether it's a ghost or time travel, they all have some aspect that's going to take it out of the straight realism, which feels like it might fit here, given what you've said about Ellie Hazelwood. Ashley Poston.
Courtney and I met in your store, Emily, when she came there for the launch of The Witches of Moonshine Manor. And it was just the day before that she had signed with her agent. So it was just wonderful to see her journey to publication.
Oh, it was so exciting. We talked about that. She just did an event at East City Bookshop and I introduced her. And it was wonderful to make that connection and just feel how full circle it is. And one of the most fun things in the bookstore is getting to follow an author's career. Yours, Courtney's, Steve Rowley's. I mean, it's just, we've got the best job. So it's so fun to watch people succeed and watch their career take off.
Yeah, and we get to talk about all the booksellers we love, which is awesome. So for our listeners, listen out for that interview with Courtney. It's a great one. Okay, number 18.
Hi, Emily. I've recently completed a memoir about what we owe our children, written from my perspective as both a daughter and a mother. In 65,000 words, I trace the evolution of the emotional love affair between me and my dad and explore the many ways he broke the boundaries between parent and child before his suicide at 65. Becoming a parent myself launched me on a journey to understand the past and change the future for me and my children by breaking the cycle of intergenerational trauma. My story will resonate with readers who are grappling with the mess suicide leaves behind, as well as those who grew up in the ashes of a messy divorce or who dream of doing better for their children than their own parents managed for them. Comps I'm currently considering include Never Simple by Liz Shire, Negative Space by Lily Danziger, and Wild Game by Adrian Brodeur, which is older but maybe okay as a third comp? I'd love your take on these and any others you might recommend. Thank you.
Okay, three wonderful comps that you have already suggested here. Never Simple by Liz Shire, one of the greats in terms of a complicated parent-child relationship and breaking the cycle. Negative Space by Lily Danziger. I think that's a small book. I think the opposite of sometimes a title is too big. I don't know that this one is big enough, but I think it's an excellent comp. And if you're sending it to the right agent and the right, you know, querying, that's a great one. I love Wild Game by Adrian Brodeur, and that feels like it just came out to me, although I know it's been a few years now, but it doesn't feel too old to me. I think those are wonderful. And the one that I will add is Rebel Girl by Kathleen Hanna, which just came out last week or the week before. So Kathleen Hanna was the original Riot Girl, a pioneer of Pacific Northwest punk. She was in Bikini Kill. This is a music memoir, but it is more than that. And at its heart, a lot of it is about her upbringing and her family. Her parents also had a terrible, messy divorce. And her father pushed all the boundaries, he didn't just push them, he crossed lots of boundaries, very inappropriate. And she talks about how she has broken that cycle. But there's a lot in it about her relationship with her father specifically and his poor choices and how she's moved away from that. So I think that's a good one, even though it's a music memoir in addition.
Wonderful. Okay, here's our second last one.
Hi, I'm hoping for comp title help, please. My book is book club fiction, mainstream contemporary. A 65-year-old baby boomer becomes an eco-terrorist catalyzed by her adult daughter crashing her retirement in Florida after the death of her husband. The comp titles that I am looking at, potentially, I'd love your thoughts on it, include Killers of a Certain Age because of the demographic of those characters and the rompiness. I have been told that mine is a little bit of a romp. I'm also potentially looking at The Bee Sting because it's a little bit more of a serious treatment of how a family deals with grief, but it has some elements of humor. I would say I am a little bit more serious and literary than Killers of a Certain Age, but a little bit less serious and rompier and less literary than The Bee Sting. I'm curious if you think those are good comps and if you have any other suggestions. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Okay, we love Killers of a Certain Age in my store. My coworker Emma hand sells that one all the time. I also like that you use the word romp because that gives me a tone and knows what I'm dealing with. I also like that you have positioned your book as more literary than Killers of a Certain Age, but less literary than The Bee Sting. And what I thought of immediately is I think of someone like Nathan Hill, who is so good. I think his earlier book, The Knicks, might be more appropriate here, but his recent book, Wellness, just came out last year, so it is timely. But both of them hit that really sweet spot of extremely readable, but still very literary, very funny, very timely. So he's always dealing with like mainstream contemporary issues, but it's also a pleasure to read. And I would put him in terms of style, I would put him squarely in between Deanna Raiborne and Paul Murray. So check out Nathan Hill, The Knicks, and Wellness.
Wonderful. Okay, here's our last one.
Hi, this is Alex. Thank you so much for this amazing service. My manuscript is an upmarket suspense set in a remote lakeside village in British Columbia amid closing in wildfires. Former teen mom goes back to where her son died 10 years earlier to get answers. Then she decides to kill the people she holds responsible, only to find out that someone else is killing them first. It's told in first person present with some second person in which she speaks to her dead son. It explores themes of mom guilt, revenge, hypocrisy, grief, and there's some climate issues in there as well. I was thinking of I Have Some Questions for You by Rebecca Mackay for the returning to the scene of the crime element as well as second person. And I was also thinking of the movie Promising Young Woman for the revenge angle, but I don't have anything yet for the mom guilt turned revenge or the climate fiction or for the thriller aspect of someone else killing her would-be victims.
The last one. Okay, this book sounds really good. This is a book that I would read. A lot of these are books that I would read. So if I didn't say that about yours, that doesn't mean I wouldn't read it. But some of them, I'm just like, yes, that is an Emily book. I love the mention of Promising Young Woman. I have some questions for you. I think there are a lot of books out there about the main character returning to the site of a past crime. And I'm not sure that this one, based on what you've said, would be exactly the right one. I will think of some others, and I'm sure listeners will have other suggestions. But I would say I have some questions for you. Has so much else going on that it might not be exactly right. For the revenge aspects, as well as the realization that someone else is also killing people, I will suggest an ECB shop favorite, Never Saw Me Coming by Vera Kurian. In the words of Taylor Swift, it's got some vigilante shit in it, but it also has the aspect of, wait, I am trying to hunt this person and someone else is hunting other people and maybe me. It's excellent. When I sell it to people, I say a book about psychopaths should not be this much fun, but it is. It's also set in DC, and we all agree in DC that she gets it right. Even though there's a fictional university, Vera Kurian gets DC right. She's from there, and you can tell. For the motherhood aspects, maybe look at None of This is True by Lisa Jewell, which I recently read and liked immensely. And then for the climate suspense, I will suggest another book by Bruce Holzinger. I recommended his book, The Gifted School, earlier, but his more recent book is called Displacement, and that is very much climate fiction, cli-fi, although it deals more with the disaster and the aftermath of the disaster as opposed to an approaching issue. And it's a storm as opposed to fires, but it's very good climate suspense if you're interested in checking it out. And that's it.
Amazing. Yay. Someone else who writes fun psychopaths as well is Eliza Jane Brazier. She wrote Goodrich People and Girls and Their Horses. Maybe check that out as well, just from that side of it. Emily, thank you so much. This was really a lot. We really appreciate it. Enjoy your time off in June and July, and we will see you back again in August.
Thank you so much. And if people are in DC, please come to East City Bookshop and say hello.
And spend money there.
That too. And you can do that online if you'd like.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues, but for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre
and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time. Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 31st of July, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of August. For more information and to register, go to biancamurray.com and look for the Beta Reader matchup tab, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be.